everyone. This is Cameron Marceau with Black Liver Project, reanimating another of our early episodes, episode number 6, the martini, one of the biggest drinks ever. It's a crazy, massively popular drink. You know, we did that one early on, of course. I'm surprised it wasn't number 2, honestly. My researcher, Jay Cruz, he plumbed the depths of the history on the martini to figure it out. And we had a good conversation at that time. What we talk about with the martini a lot of times is a little bit more about its nature. And in fact, when I talk to bartenders, that's one of the conversations I enjoy having, is like how it all works. But once again, I'm here with Mr. Doug Staley, who did a little research to check our work and see how we did. How's it going, Doug?
Okay, not bad.
Awesome. Excellent, excellent. Okay, so the martini. The martini is a classic drink, and the way I think of the martini is we need the martini more than it needs us. It's we have to have a drink called a martini in our culture. It may not look like it did 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Every generation, the martini undergoes a change, unlike any other drink that's out there. Some drinks have changed, but usually they kind of change, you know, and then they stick with the recipe. But the martini seems to move. It seems to adjust based off of what we want. The martini started as a gin and vermouth and bitters cocktail. And then over time, it lost the bitters. And then it lost the vermouth. So it was just a glass of cold gin. And then eventually it became a glass of cold vodka. And now people add things like olive brine and all different kinds of things. You will find restaurants with martini menus where there's a bunch of different martinis. But the problem I have is I don't even know what one is. It changes so much, but we always have to have a martini. Every generation has martinis, even though they don't look like the previous ones. And when I talk to bartenders, I ask them, if someone orders a martini, what do you do? Because what are they asking for? They have to hand a questionnaire to them and figure out what actually they are asking for. What makes a martini in this case? Is it the gin? Is it the vermouth? Is it the glass? The way we serve it? Because none of those are standard. I think a lot of times people think of a martini is in that seductive V-shaped glass. That makes a martini. But I think originally they were probably served in rocks glasses.
Or small champagne coupes.
Yeah, okay.
Which would have been more curved.
And lately I've asked bartenders and they've told me it's the vermouth that makes a martini. I don't know, but Winston Churchill didn't drink martinis with vermouth. So, I don't know. But as I recall, even the history on this one was elusive. So I invited Doug to come in and talk with us about, you know, maybe some other depth on the drink, see if there's any other stories, because in the previous 5 he's been able to flesh out some of the history and some of the world at the time that really makes a huge difference. So let's shed some more light on this. Doug, with the martini, do you like martinis? Are you a martini?
Absolutely. That's really where all this started. I mean, you know, a much younger me enjoying martinis, basically, you know, probably I was in my late 30s, early 40s. But although I've had martinis pretty much my whole life, you know, but I used to drink them quite a bit.
What is your martini? How do you make a martini?
Well, nowadays, I still, you know, because I'm looking at a lot of old fashioned recipes from before Prohibition, and it was typical back then to have either 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 in terms of the ratio between gin and vermouth. There was quite a bit of vermouth in the old versions of the drink. And I mean, 2-to-1 is not uncommon for me. It's generally the way I'll do it is 2 parts to 1 part, maybe with a little orange bitters in it. But I frequently will mix half of sweet vermouth and half dry vermouth and put orange bitters in that. And that's actually the one I drink most nowadays.
Really? So you make something a little more perfect.
Yes.
Okay. Wow. Okay. See, I have to admit, I'm not a huge fan of the martinis that a lot of people drink. It's okay, gin and vermouth, but I often do choose to add some bitters. I've got different kinds of bitters, and I'll just put a couple dashes of whatever just to flavor it up a little bit more. That's the way I roll. So what do you think of the background on this one?
Well, the martini really comes out of the Manhattan. Right around, and we talked about the Manhattan earlier.
It's the same recipe, right?
Except with gin instead of whiskey.
Yeah.
And the earliest martinis were often the recipe was just a Manhattan except with gin instead of whiskey.
Yeah.
And there's a few cases of the recipe just being left at that. So what we know pretty much is that, you know, the dry vermouth came later, mostly in the second half of the 1890s, when people got tired of sweet drinks and were looking for a savory drink, you know.
Okay.
There aren't a whole lot of savory drinks. You know, the dry martini is really it, except there's a few others that I know of. There are dry versions of the Manhattan, although how many people actually drink them, or ever did, you know. But you see scotch and whiskey being mixed with dry vermouth in the 1890s. People are starting to experiment with that sort of thing. But really, the earliest drinks, you would see references to a turf club cocktail that was, and there was ambiguity as to whether the turf club had whiskey or gin in it. Different people will tell you different things. And we're talking, you know, about the early 1880s. By 1884, we have a drink called the Martinez, which shows up in O.H. Byron's book, along with the Collins recipe and a bunch of other stuff. And one of the first Manhattan recipes, too, all in this 1884 book by the pseudonym O.H. Byron, called The Modern Bartender's Guide. And no one really knows who O.H. Byron actually was, but they're pretty much convinced that was a nom de plume.
Okay.
And so in 1884, he refers to the Martinez, and the recipe is same as Manhattan, only you substitute gin for whiskey.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the earliest we have. There were some others from that year that the Turf Club cocktail in G. Winter Company's book, which also was another one that had one of the first Manhattan recipes, and this was also in 1884. And he has a Turf Club cocktail in there that is 2 or 3 dashes of Peruvian bitters, 1/2 glass of Tom Gin, and 1/2 wine glass of Italian vermouth. So it's pretty much equal parts of Old Tom Gin, which is a little sweeter. It's got Italian vermouth, which is going to be sweeter, and then bitters in that. And that pretty much, you know, becomes the drink up until the late 1890s. It was a sweet drink with bitters. Both the Manhattan and the Martini, when they originally came out, sometimes you would see some simple syrup added to them and other things. It was sort of evolving out of the old-fashioned cocktail. They start off sort of as old-fashioned cocktails and also have vermouth in them.
Yeah.
And it's always a sweet vermouth, most likely a Torino-style vermouth that was used around that time. The dry vermouth starts to come in at like around 1896 or so.
So did it not exist prior to 1896?
Which one?
The dry vermouth. Did it?
It was definitely imported. There was dry vermouth imported for a couple of decades before that, but nobody actually, I think, used it to mix until the 1890s. I certainly haven't found any recipes that
It was just a sipper. You'd like get it at a cafe and you'd, you know, like have a little glass of it or something.
Yeah, or maybe some soda water or something. Okay. There were definitely vermouth cocktails that had no liquor in them, just vermouth and whatever you mixed it with.
Okay.
Bitters and sugar usually, of course, there's being an old-fashioned style type of drink. But then in 1885, an article in the Boston Herald mentions the martini. And that's the first time that drink is referred to. Although you see people refer to martinas with an A and martines with an E on the end. And this is what I find to be most interesting are these martine cocktails. Because one thing I turned up while digging through all of this, and I don't know if anybody found this before. I mean, I've run it by a lot of people who know. This is something that kind of got by everybody. And one reason being that the New York Herald digital archives are not really on a lot of are not really complete on a lot of these sites. The Fulton History site was where I found it because they have a much more complete New York Herald archive. Unfortunately, that issue is offline right now. I've reported it to the guy that runs the site and he's aware of it. But luckily, before all that, I was able to, long ago, I downloaded the relevant article from it, and it's an obituary.
Oh, wow.
From September 19th, 1891. A man who was only named Franklin Martine passed away. And it says in his obituary, which is a paragraph here, Franklin Martine, one of the best known members of the Union and Racket Clubs, who was especially famous as the inventor of that mixture of gin and vermouth, known as the Martine cocktail, died yesterday at the New York Hospital of Rheumatic Troubles. He was 48 years old. Frank Martine, as he was generally known, was a member of the sporting element to which Wright Sanford, Herman Erlich's, Fred Gebbard, Charles A. Childs, and Chester Griswold belonged, and was for a number of years a prominent figure in the 7th Regiment. He was engaged in the harness trade, but had not been in active business life for several years. His wife, who was a Miss Garrett, survives him. Also a child, which the obituary didn't mention. But the thing is that Martine was a Civil War veteran. He'd served in the 7th Regiment and been an officer in the 7th Regiment.
Oh, wow.
At least after. I mean, you see mentioned as an officer in around 1870 or so.
Wait, it was 1891 and he died, right? Mm-hmm. And he was 48.
Yeah.
So let's see. How old was he when he was in Civil War?
I don't know. That would have been, he would have been quite, probably, late teens, early 20s. He was born in 1843, so he would have been 18 in 1861.
Okay, not so weird.
And he came from quite a lot of money. Yeah, his father had been in the carriage trade, the very high end of the carriage trade, people who did fittings and fitted out carriages, sort of the equivalent of somebody selling high-end cars nowadays. His father, S.A. Martine, Samuel Martine, was smart with his money. He invested in real estate quite heavily and ended up buying, I believe, 17 one-acre plots in what's now downtown White Plains, New York. Now, that's a affluent area, to say the least, and the property became worth quite a bit of money during the time he held that. So there was a lot of cash in that family. Martine had brothers and a sister, but the sister survived, but none of his brothers lived as long as he did. Some of them died quite young, and so he was pretty much the son who was going to inherit everything, and that's how he lived his life. He was a club man. He was a sport. He went to the races or whatever, boxing matches and saloons. And mostly he was known for party committees for organizations like the Union League and also the Carriage Fitters had an association, and he was on the entertainment committee. So he definitely sounds like the kind of guy who might have invented the martini.
Okay.
What we find about him is that, about his father is that his mother died around 1869, 1870. His father was still in his late 50s at that point. 3 years later, around 1873, S.A. Martine remarries. He marries a much younger woman. Right around the age of 60, pushing 60, has another son.
Oh my God.
This is unexpected for poor Franklin, who had expected he was going to get everything, but now his elderly father is doting on the new child. And he doesn't live much longer than that. About 3 years later, 1876, S.A. Martin passes away, leaving his wife a widow. His legacy is the money that he's left behind, and his business, the carriage trade business, is all put into probate. Now, this is where it gets kind of hairy, in that you see Franklin Martin was friends with the executors. In fact, actually, one of them was a relative. He conspires with them to have the business, while still in probate, transferred to him for a minimal fee, like a buck or whatever, you know, like that. Of course, it was illegal then as it is now. Uh-huh. You can't sell property that's in probate. But who was going to go after him? A three-year-old child and a grieving widow, you know, which is basically what they thought they would get away with. But Kitty Clark Nye, who was the younger woman, the wife of S.A. Martin, remarried very quickly a man named Clark A. Griggs, who had been mayor of Union, Ohio, and had been a would-be railroad tycoon. And he actually had quite a bit of doings in the railroad business, but he got put out of business due to problems with suppliers or whatever. Anyway, in the ongoing legal ramifications of him losing his railway, he found his true calling in life, which was suing people. and he was in a very litigious age. He was known as one of the most litigious out there, and the New York Times even had a headline remarking on one court case he had that had dragged on for over a decade. Basically, she marries this guy who really knows the law, but she was putting on a bunch of weight, and so she starts taking this patent weight loss medication, which was very toxic and killed her.
Oh my God.
It was very, it was extremely tragic. Her death was really painful and awful. I mean, it was, in fact, one of the things that her now widowed husband did was to go also to go after the patent medicine industry because of this. And this was in the papers all over the country and started to. It was the beginning of the pushback against patent medicine in a big way. I mean, you know, right in that same, not necessarily the cause of it, but in that same era when people started to realize that patent medicine could be really, really bad for you. Okay. But anyway, here we have Clark Griggs, who now has a son.
And yeah.
No, from another man who's now, he's responsible for it.
Yeah.
And he looks into the books and finds out what's gone on with Franklin Martin and his executors, and launches a massive lawsuit against them, which drags on for several years once again. And Martin actually attempted to sell his interest out to his executors so that he could get out of the lawsuit. But because that stuff was still in probate, he gets sued again. And so he's really stuck. And I don't know, he gets out of it by dying at the age of 48.
Oh, wow.
And then the case dragged on for years after that with the executors representing him. So it didn't end well for him.
That's just a whole big mess of crap that, oh my God. But it seems so timely. Like it seems like that kind of thing is just what made up the late 1800s.
Exactly. I kept coming across things like people dying of patent medicine. And,
yeah.
And trying to sell things in probate and stuff like that. All the things, you know, these shenanigans, basically, which, you know, are kind of timeless in a way, at least in America. But, you know, it's an interesting story. And one of the names off of that list of the sporting element to which he belonged was a man named Herman Ulrichs, who was actually William Vanderbilt's brother-in-law.
Oh, my God.
He married a Vanderbilt. And we find other cases where Ehrlich's so socializing with the Martins. And so it's known that they were friends. Ehrlich's was a major sporting dude. I don't want to use the term dude because he hated the dudes. The dudes were like dandies at the time, and Ehrlich's loved to rag on them, basically. He was quite a big athletic guy. He was an ocean swimmer. He literally swam with the sharks. The ship's captains actually had a joke that you knew you were getting close to the port of New York when you saw Herman Ehrlich swimming near your boat. And actually, Ehrlich had a wager that he publicized quite a bit. $10,000 for anybody who proved that they'd actually ever been attacked by a shark. He believed the sharks didn't attack people. This is his big thing in the papers, is that he was very controversial about this belief that sharks never really attacked humans.
Did he get eaten by a shark?
No, he didn't. The sharks never came near him. They were afraid of him, probably. I don't know, but
like that guy who you would hang out with the grizzly bears up in Alaska. You know, it's like, oh, they're so nice. And then he gets eaten. So he was a shark whisperer.
Exactly. But he was also a big practical joker. And so this kind of alerted me. Who funded this obituary? Who put it up there and mentioned, you know, that Franklin Martine had invented the Martine cocktail? Was this a practical joke among his friends? Because it's exactly the kind of practical joke they play.
Because you weren't able to verify anything past what that obituary. You were able to verify that those are real people, which is something that we've encountered before, where there's a list of people and we're like, I don't think any of those people actually existed.
These people all existed. And I found most of them. And we know that Martine was involved with some social activities as well. So here's somebody who definitely was a sport from that era, who was involved with entertainment committees for clubs and organizations, and had quite a deal of money and quite a life. Basically, if anybody invented the martini, probably him, but we can't really be certain of that. You know, the one thing we know coming out of all of that is the term Martine cocktail was not unusual at the time, starting with Harry Johnson in his 1888 cocktail recipe book. The 1888 version was in English, and there was a separate section in German on the back. And the German section has illustrations of the drinks. And although the drink is referred to as a martini cocktail in the recipe, there's a picture of the drink in that book, page 145, that says Martine cocktail, not martini. And this might have been a typo, except I found about four or five other references here in 1893, the Chicago Tribune, in an article about bartenders meeting to discuss their recipes, cocktails figure on the first day's program, Manhattan Martine. Champagne and old-fashioned cocktails are now mixed in various methods in different cities. And there's another reference. Neither is the Martine cocktail the dude feed. The same innocuous beverage in Boston as in Chicago. Actually, here, this is an interesting thing. They differ in degrees of glory, said Archie McGraw of the Major Saloon. The Manhattan, with lots of whiskey but little vermouth, such as is tangled for office seekers suffering from hope long deferred in Washington City, is not the soothing Manhattan mixed for the successful Chicago businessman. Neither is the Martine cocktail the dude feed, the same innocuous beverage in Boston as in Chicago, suggested Pete Kelly of Varnell's. The vermouth floats in a rolling sea of gin in Boston, and the Boston dude knows not Bunker Hill from the mountain of remorse following a drunk created by the insinuating drink. But is mixed in Chicago, it simply wraps the dude in a sweet snoreless slumber. So basically they're talking about differences in the recipes, but here twice he refers to the martini cocktail as the Martine, and this is in 1893. Then we have Charles Ranhofer, who had been the head chef at Delmonico's in Manhattan. And he wrote a book in 1894 called The Epicure, in which he provides a recipe for the drink. And he once again refers to it as the Martine cocktail. And I found another ad where premixed cocktails were being sold from about 1909, and they're still calling it the Martine in that. So the term Martine shows up again and again, really, in these early sources. But then again, so does Martinez, so does Martini, even Martina. All of them show up in various places. But there are probably about half a dozen references to the Martine cocktail.
Is any one of them more prevalent? I mean, I think of the Martinez as being almost like a separate drink. Like it's like it kind of existed at the same time as the Martine, and maybe the Martini came out of it, right? Mm-hmm. But like, I feel like it's kind of a like still considered a separate drink, but like a Martina, Martine, Martini. Does any of them in that time frame, any of them where it's more prevalent, where it seems like people are calling it that more?
I think Martini was probably the most prevalent, followed by Martinez.
Okay.
Yeah, the others less so, probably maybe five or six references to the Martine cocktail.
Okay.
But outside of that, really, there's a lot of variation. There was confusion at the very beginning. You know, it's like, was the Turf Club cocktail a Manhattan or a Martini? It depends on which source you're looking at, you know. So it's hard to say. And once again, the bartenders were saying in different cities it varies too. So, you know, there wasn't any real mass media back then that would have spread the word. It was all word of mouth.
Or someone would write an article and then it would kind of blow up. But, you know, there didn't seem to be the same kind of care taken with the naming or the recipes. Like back then, it seemed like you kind of got close. You just named something and you had your own version, you know, and no one seemed to care. It wasn't until after Prohibition when they started buttoning everything up.
Well, I think by the late 1890s, the term Martini had more or less taken. By 1895, there's multiple cocktail guys referencing it. The dry Martini comes into existence right around that time. That takes off and becomes much more popular as people get tired of sweet drinks.
Uh-huh.
It had that air of sophistication, you know.
Yeah.
And back then, like, there was still considerably more vermouth in the drinks back then. Vermouth starts to become less popular, I think, when Prohibition kicks in and the cocktail center of the world is no longer America. It's now Europe. And the Europeans start putting less and less vermouth in continuously and making it drier and drier. You know, it's questionable whether they actually ever got the American concept of a martini. It all goes downhill from there.
Yeah.
And you know, also, it's interesting. I was looking at when people first started talking about chilling vermouth, because, you know, it's a lot of people have the illusion that aromatized wine somehow lasts out of the fridge once it's been open for longer than regular wine would. And no, it doesn't. It goes bad in about 3 days. And that was an era when nobody kept their vermouth in the fridge. My dad it in the liquor cabinet with the gin. It was believed that you didn't have to refrigerate it. And really until maybe the late 50s, early 60s, you don't hear anybody talking about that. It was one or two people, and it more and more as you get into the 1980s. And if you don't refrigerate your vermouth, you're not going to want to put a lot of it into your martini. It's been open for a few days. You know?
Yeah. Huh. Well, that actually makes me wonder about, you know, like, you know, how vermouth would have been a little bit harder to like use in a recipe because, yeah, refrigeration wasn't a thing for a lot of people, or, you know, and also the price of it. I mean, if you're going to open a bottle of vermouth, kind of like the champagne cocktails, it's like the bartender would be like, okay, who else is having one? You know, we've got to drink this.
Yeah. Well, the bars would go through it much more quickly, and so they didn't have to worry about it going bad. You know, So really, they may not have refrigerated it there, because once it got open, it was probably going to be emptied in an evening or so, maybe 2 days at the longest. And so really, people got the idea that you didn't have to refrigerate it once you opened it, but you do. Okay. And that may have led to it becoming less popular. I think once it got over to Europe, people didn't really know what to make of it. It was like, you know, vermouth was used extensively in aperitif type drinks that were much lighter, but to bake it, put it in a strong drink like that was kind of unusual. It didn't have any cultural basis in Europe. It all just came from America. For one reason or another, preferred less vermouth. And you start to see this more and more. And as you get into the 1950s, after repeal, a lot of what Americans knew about mixed drinks was coming from Europe at that point, because it had been 13 years here and a lot of people had forgot. Yeah, there's a lot of spurious mythology that comes up right around repeal for a lot of areas of mixing.
Wow. Well, so is that's what you found on the martini?
Yeah, basically that's my claim to fame on the martini, was discovering the obituary of Frank Martin and his bizarre life. And
that's a great story. It really is. I mean, as we go forward, we see more of these kinds of characters, and I'm actually really interested in seeing what you can find out more than what we found out in some of these cases, because it's a slice of life. And I think that that's cool, because we don't get this sense. And when you really kind of explore it, then you put everything into the context, and that just brings it to life more. So I have a feeling as I go forward with the original podcast and we start talking about these times again, I'm just going to approach it with a whole different attitude, because I'm seeing more and more of who these people were and how they acted and what they did. So yeah, this is really pretty eye-opening. I enjoy this. Well, thanks once again, Doug. We are going to press forward. Black Liver Project is my group, people who I work with talking about alcohol and stuff and different perspectives. I post things on the social medias. You can find stuff under Black Liver Project. If you do, you can hashtag Black Liver Project and find me wherever I am posting. And along with these shows, I'm bopping around Chicago and trying different bars, cocktails as we promote them. So yeah, if you want to follow, please do. And Doug, what's your handle and where can people find you?
Oh, I'm posting still as Libation Legacy. I've got a WordPress page, libationlegacy.wordpress.com. And mostly nowadays I'm on Blue Sky. Although, there's still a Twitter account for Libation Legacy, but I don't really use it. There's some Mastodon presence for a while, but I moved to Blue Sky several months ago and I've been very happy there. And so that's basically been where I'm focused at this point in terms of social media.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. The whole social media world is kind of shattered. It's like, wow. Oh my gosh. It's definitely not like it was back in, I think I got on Facebook in 2007.
Oh yeah. And that was MySpace before that.
Yeah, I touched on that, but I think I found Facebook first and it was amazing at the time, but now I don't. Occasionally I go on and scroll, but I doom scroll, but I don't but I just don't go anymore. There's just nothing there for me. But this is social media is still a way to like promote what we do. So, I have a presence and I can have some fun with people there too. In any case, everyone keep on thinking and drinking as we go forward. I think we've got, episode number 7, the Gimlet.
The Gimlet.
Okay. I'll see you in a couple of weeks again. Take care.
Sure thing, Dan. You take care too.